Today is Friday, August 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up, Karen Bass, House of Representatives.
All of us know that some of our family members, some of our ancestors were in those dungeons. And just the knowledge of that is powerful and painful.
Also ahead, at least four people have been injured in a series of bomb blasts across Bangkok. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States today pulled out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, INF, treaty to develop its own new warheads after the Russians refused to destroy new missiles that NATO says violate the pact. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blamed Russia for the treaty's demise because of its failure to comply with its restrictions on deploying new missiles in Europe. Today, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg rejected Russia's offer of a moratorium on intermediate-range missiles, saying the plan lacked any credibility because of Moscow's growing new missile arsenal. Steve Herman, VOA's White House correspondent, joins us now by phone to discuss the end of the INF. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Sure.
And first, Steve, what led up to the U.S. withdrawal from the treaty?
Well, this was no surprise. The U.S. had signaled 6 months ago that it was going to do this unless the Russians took action to destroy their new missiles that NATO says violates the pact. That didn't happen, and so the U.S. went ahead with the pullout from the INF treaty.
So what is the Russian position?
Well, the Russians are saying that they haven't violated the treaty. And, of course, the United States and NATO say that's definitely not the case. And Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, a month ago signed legislation suspending his country's participation in the treaty, and that came 5 months after the Trump administration made the same move.
Talking about President Vladimir Putin, President Donald Trump has repeatedly said he has a good relationship with the Russian president. Why weren't they able to close the gap on this dispute?
Well, in the views of people here at the White House, is because Putin or nobody else in Russia made any move to get back in compliance with the treaty, and despite what there may be as far as good will and good feelings between the two presidents, it was inevitable that with what was going on, that essentially this treaty has been jettisoned separately, and you could argue jointly, by Moscow and Washington.
So, Steve, what do defense experts say are the implications for the end of this treaty?
Well, they are fearing an arms race because the United States will now build some new missiles and perhaps place them in Asia, which would cause the Chinese to possibly introduce a new wave of systems as a counter. One bright spot is I asked President Trump yesterday about the U.S. withdrawal, and he said that both he and Russia were interested in negotiating a new treaty on nuclear-capable missiles. So we'll have to see if that does happen.
Steve Herman, VOA White House correspondent, thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
Among the top stories in the world, President Reagan's daughter apologizes for her father's racist comments. Japan has removed South Korea from a list of its preferred trading partners. China criticizes Trump's proposed tariff hike. And Boris Johnson's party suffers defeat in UK's special election. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com website and our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
Hey, Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
At least four people have been injured in a series of bomb blasts across Bangkok today as the Thai capital hosts foreign and defense ministers at an annual meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The meeting includes U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and other top diplomats from ASEAN's main partners, including Japan and China. Steve Boitano is a journalist working in Bangkok. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson today about the blasts, several of which struck near stations for Bangkok's elevated rail system, the BTS.
There was six explosions in Bangkok, starting at 7 a.m. at the government complex, followed by 8:30 at a BTS station, and then around 9 o'clock in another area, more remote area outside of Bangkok.
Were these blasts very large? Were there significant injuries?
No, they were fairly small explosions. Some may have been ping pong bombs planted in bushes by the road. There were three injuries. One was more serious, but not life-threatening.
Now, what has the reaction been in the city? I mean, it's a crowded city to begin with. Did they have to close down the BTS, which is the Bangkok Transit system, or any other actions?
Now, of course, around the area, directly around the areas of the explosions, there was road closures or closing off portions of the road. The BTS did not close. They closed off a few exits in areas you couldn't access while the investigations were underway. But everything was pretty much as normal. All right. Going through town.
Now, right now in Bangkok, we have the ASEAN Summit for Foreign and Defense Ministers for the members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, as well as their key partners such as China, the United States, and Japan. Were these bomb attacks in any way connected to or near the location of that summit?
There was no direct connection to it, as we can see. They were not near the summit area at all. It may have been more symbolic for the timing, as Pompeo had a speech in the morning. But as far as I know, that's it.
Right. Now, police apparently aren't saying very much about this. So there's been no indication of who's available. Is that right? Who's responsible?
No, there isn't anything. There's nothing certain of these bombings. There was an incident the night before of two people planting a bomb in front of a fake bomb in front of the police station, and they made two arrests in that case. But the six bombs detonated today, there isn't any full leads on this.
That was reporter Stephen Boitano in Bangkok. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Despite the bombings that rattled Bangkok today, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stayed on message about the main priorities of his visit. The Trump administration is invested in the sovereignty, in the resilience, and the prosperity of each Southeast Asian nation, Pompeo said today in a speech to a regional youth leadership program in Bangkok. During the ASEAN gathering this week, he chided China for over several issues, such as China's growing military presence in the South China Sea. Trade was a particular key message for the top U.S. diplomat, as President Donald Trump threatens more tariffs on Chinese goods.
For decades, China has taken advantage of trade. taking advantage of trade versus the United States of America, taking advantage of trade versus countries in Asia and Southeast Asia. And it's time for that to stop. And President Trump has said, we're going to fix this. And to fix it requires determination, and that's, I think, what you saw this morning. The president is determined to achieve this outcome. What we're asking for is really easy. Indeed, the Chinese had agreed to it at one point and then walked away from the deal.
Pompeo said he is optimistic talks with North Korea will resume shortly, although North Korea's Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho did not show up for a scheduled meeting Thursday.
We are still fully committed to achieving the outcome that we've laid out, the fully verified denuclearization of North Korea, and to do so through the use of diplomacy.
U.S. officials did not appear to be too concerned by North Korea's latest test firing of two short-range ballistic missiles today. A Pentagon official said the missiles were not a threat to South Korea and have no impact on our defense posture. You are listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have found an exoplanet that can be described as hotter than hot. Called WASP-121b, the planet is so hot that scientists say they have detected magnesium and iron gas streaming into space from its atmosphere instead of condensing into metallic clouds. Not only is it shedding elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, but the planet also orbits so close to its host star that its upper atmosphere temperature reaches over 2,500 degrees Celsius. The star's gravitational pull is so strong that the planet has been stretched to look like an American football and is said to be on the edge of being ripped apart. WASP-121b was discovered in 2015, is about 900 light-years from Earth, and located in the constellation Puppis. A study detailing the astronomers' findings has been published in the Astronomical Journal. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This week, a military delegation from the United Arab Emirates visited Tehran to discuss border cooperation between the two countries. The talks come despite recent tensions in the Strait of Hormuz and the military conflict in Yemen, where the UAE is part of a Saudi-led coalition fighting Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Also this week, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Jawad Zarif said his country is ready for a dialogue if Saudi Arabia is also ready, and he added that Iran will never close the door to dialogue with its neighbors. Omani Foreign Minister Yusuf bin Alawi also recently met with Iranian officials in Tehran. He says Oman is not undertaking mediation efforts for the disputing nations in the Gulf, but is in contact with all parties to maintain stability in the Strait of Hormuz. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen about this diplomatic gestures and the prospects of eventual negotiations with Iran.
I think the UAE demonstrated a preference for a diplomatic solution, and that's even within the context of this maximum pressure campaign on Iran. It would like to see that pressure as a means to an end, and the end would be an opportunity to negotiate a resolution of the conflict and the tensions with Iran by all the parties in the region. So I think the UAE sees that it needs to take the initiative here and demonstrate that it will take advantage of the opportunity and hopefully draw Iran into a dialogue and begin to set a stage on which other parties to the conflict can also participate.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Jawad Zarif said Iran is ready for dialogue if Saudi Arabia is also ready, and he added that Iran would never close the door to dialogue with its neighbors. How feasible is such dialogue while the Saudis are backing the maximum pressure the U.S. is practicing against the Iranian regime?
I think at the moment, probably not terribly likely, and it's not just because Saudi Arabia is in sync or certainly in agreement with the United States' position, but also because Iran itself has been demonstrating a very provocative posture and behavior in the Gulf. So I think both parties, if there's going to be a dialogue between Saudi Arabia and Iran, both parties have got to be prepared to step down from their maximum position, either maximum pressure on one side or maximum resistance on the other side, and demonstrate a willingness and an appetite to compromise. Dialogue will never begin if parties to a conflict or a disagreement are going to adopt and insist upon maintaining maximalist positions.
Omani Foreign Minister Yusuf bin Alawi met Iranian officials in Tehran, but he said Oman is not undertaking any mediation efforts around rising tensions in the Gulf, but is in contact with all parties to maintain stability in the Straits of Hormuz. What do you make of that?
I think that's very much in keeping with Oman's preferred role. It doesn't want to be seen as getting ahead of processes that other countries may be involved in. It doesn't want to be seen as a mediator if there's not mediation going on. It would be much rather be very quietly working behind the scenes, trying to persuade parties that are more involved in the conflict than it is. And of course, it has stepped back from these tensions to a great extent. It doesn't like to be involved in that. Its role, as it defines itself, is to be the party that can have conversations and dialogue with all of the other nations and all the other countries and all the other parties in the region to help them and help encourage them to see their way around the conflict towards a mediated settlement. And I think that's, again, it's a quiet diplomacy that Oman practices very efficiently, but it doesn't want to be seen as taking the lead in these disputes.
The U.S. is offering to negotiate with Iran for several times, but Iran is reluctant. What would open the door for negotiations between the U.S. and Iran?
The U.S. has said it will sit down with Iran without preconditions, but on the other hand, it has also established a very stringent sanctions regime that is punishing Iran's economy by suspending exports of oil to anyone in the world, and it's also restricting the ability of Iran to do a lot of other participation in the economic global system. So I think there's a lot of reasons why there's still, in Iran's view, preconditions it by the U.S. it would like to see removed, too. So I think, again, I think both parties have got to find a way to say we will give a little bit to demonstrate a willingness to compromise so that dialogue becomes more likely. I don't know that either party at this point has made enough in terms of a concession to the other to say there is something we can do that will allow us to clear the table of a lot of the clutter that has built up over these years, so we have that space we need to begin a conversation that's really serious.
That was the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, who was speaking to my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawy. This is International Edition. The World Health Organization says the confirmation of a fourth case of Ebola in the eastern Congolese city of Goma complicates efforts to get the outbreak under control. Two people have died of Ebola in Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Both victims were infected outside the city, and the wife and young daughter of the second victim now have the disease. The WHO says health workers have identified more than 200 people who have come in contact with the family. These people are being monitored and vaccinated against the disease. Also today, the United Nations Security Council reiterated its concern about the outbreak, which has gone on for a year.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me every weekday evening for Africa News Tonight from the Voice of America. It's a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with the people making news in Africa. You'll hear every side of an issue. And of course, Sunny Young drops by with the sunny side of sports. Plus, we have special features on science, business, Africans abroad, and comments from listeners like you. So please join me every weekday for Africa News Tonight from the Voice of America.
U.S. House of Representatives member Karen Bass today wraps up a week-long trip to Ghana along with the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Representative Bass, a Democrat from California, spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson to talk about the trip. A key part of the trip was her visit to the historic Cape Coast and the Elimina Castles, the starting point for millions of Africans sold into slavery in the United States. This month marks the 400th anniversary of the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade.
Well, first of all, I was very honored to be a part of a delegation of the Congressional Black Caucus that was led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the most powerful woman elected official in the United States. And I think that that's very significant on the year of the 400th anniversary to go to Ghana. We met with the president, we met with the speaker, we met with members of parliament, and most notable, before we talk about Cape Coast and Elmina, was the speaker addressed parliament yesterday and delivered a message of all support and commitment to building a strong relationship between the United States and Ghana, as well as acknowledging our collective history. When members of the Black Caucus, along with the speaker, went to Cape Coast in Elmina, needless to say, it was a very tragic, a very powerful visit. It was always incredible to imagine the raw, ruthless brutality, the inhumane treatment of our people, and the fact that all of us know that some of our family members, some of our ancestors were in those dungeons. And just the knowledge of that is powerful and painful. But then on the other side of it, we also have to acknowledge that after going through the Middle Passage, after being held in dungeons, brutalized, raped, beaten, and surviving 250 years of enslavement, we as a people are incredibly strong because not only did we survive, but we have thrived in every way. And so that's what the trip meant. All of us are reflecting on it, and I know that we will be for some time, but it was an amazing experience, and we're very proud and thankful that our speaker was very interested, not just willing, but very interested in attending, participating, and learning.
Now, this is the 400th anniversary of the beginning of the slave trade between Africa and what is now the United States. How does it feel to be in Africa and at Cape Coast for this year? Is there a different feeling?
Well, I think any year that you go and visit the dungeons where our people were kept is very powerful. But of course, it had special significance this year because in Ghana, this is called the Year of Return. And the world, hopefully, will learn and understand what happened so that a time period like this can never occur again.
That was Karen Bass, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, speaking from Ghana with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. VOA will have extensive coverage in the coming days of the 400th anniversary of the start of the slave trade between Africa and North America. Please tune in throughout August to hear more.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Dan Brown, engineer, Nick Ivanov. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Have a great day.
What's up? I'm Jackson Fungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
You know, it's Upfront News Show. Blazing up the place.
Upfront looks at issues Upfront that affect you. Interesting news and, of course, music, entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it. So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America.